And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This week marked what would have been the 100th birthday of Rachel Carson, who turned nature lovers into environmentalists with the publication of Silent Spring. We give gentle tribute to the silent warrior and then bring you two special whale features along with our fifth weekly Earth Summit when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Rachel Carson would have been 100 years old this week. And throughout today's show, we will be giving gentle reminders of this giant of the environmental movement. We'll be getting right to our fifth weekly Earth Summit in just a moment. And then in segment two, we bring you the Nature News Update, then two current sagas about whales. One, a follow-up on a story we did last week on those wayward whales heading up the Sacramento River. And the second, a follow-up on a story we did a while ago about the Japanese and their quest for whales. But first, I want to read you a brief news item from this week's news. Senator Benjamin Cardin from Maryland introduced a resolution to honor pioneering environmentalist Rachel Carson on the 100th anniversary of her birth. Carson's 1962 book, Silent Spring, which revealed the harmful effects of pesticides, helped launch the environmental movement. His resolution was written acknowledging her legacy of scientific rigor, coupled with her poetic sensibility. However, the resolution was forced to be withdrawn due to action of Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, who vociferously accused Carson of using junk science to turn the public against chemicals like DDT. To date, I will read excerpts from Carson's writings. I begin with the following, which was from a letter to the editor she wrote to the Washington Post in 1953. The real wealth of the nation lies in the resources of the earth, soil, water, forests, minerals, and wildlife. To utilize them for present needs while ensuring their preservation for future generations requires a delicately balanced and continuing program based on the most extensive research. Their administration is not properly and cannot be a matter of politics. By long tradition, the agencies responsible for these resources have been directed by men of professional stature and experience who have understood, respected, and been guided by the findings of their scientists. These actions with the Interior Department fall into place beside the proposed giveaways of our offshore oil reserves and the threatened invasion of national parks, forests, and public lands. For many years, public-spirited citizens throughout the country have been working for conservation of the natural resources, realizing their vital importance to the nation. Apparently, hard-won progress is to be wiped out as a politically minded administration returns us to the dark age of unrestrained exploitation and destruction. It is one of the ironies of our times that while concentrating on the defense of our country against enemies from without, we should be so heedless to those who destroy it from within. That's the end of Rachel Carson's quote. I dedicate all of Ms. Carson's writings, which I'll read throughout the show, to Senator Coburn. I will send him a letter with these writings. So now, on to the rest of the show. It takes all kinds for change. Some of us are committed to our public lands. Some are working hard for the oceans. Many have great sympathy for the loss of the wonder as animals disappear in record numbers, while the world seems to be awakening to the specter of global weirding. That's why we bring you each week a spectrum of thoughts by our regular contributors to the Weekly Earth Summit. Let the summit begin.
Welcome
Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit. This is Sydney Wildsmith, and I've received a variety of thoughts from our regular panelists who send them out around the world each week. There's plenty to contemplate, so let's get started with Dr. Matthew Sleeth, who's about to make an offer that sounds almost too good to be true. Dr. Sleeth?
Today, I want to share how everyone can get $20,000 worth of solar equipment for just $20. Many of us want to do more to use less energy, but solar equipment such as photovoltaic panels are expensive. A modest 1.8 kilowatt system can cost about $20,000. Let's say that I did have $20,000 to spend on a photovoltaic system. How much energy could I expect to make? Nationally, $20,000 worth of equipment nets about 150 kilowatt hours of energy per month. Those in Erie will get less, and dwellers in Phoenix and San Diego will do better. So, how can you get the equipment to net 150 kilowatt hours of energy every month for just $20? Put up a clothesline. The average clothes dryer uses 150 kilowatt hours of energy a month. Clothes dryers are one of the home's big energy hogs. That's why they require the large 220-volt cords. Each load dried in a dryer makes 5 pounds of greenhouse gases. A clothesline saves 150 kilowatt hours of energy per month, and a kilowatt saved is a kilowatt earned. Additionally, you'll get a little exercise and have clothes that last twice as long. You'll never see a slick ad for clothesline, but that doesn't mean it isn't a piece of solar technology worth owning or giving as a gift.
Matthew Sleeth brings his common sense advice to the world each week from his experience in downsizing his family's lifestyle to accommodate to a sustainable future. Thank you, Dr. Sleeth. Now, good advice is sometimes overlooked, but we are finding that more frequently good science is driving some provocative new ideas, and it's beginning to show up in meaningful changes. Dr. Mark Beckhoff works with animals to explore and then promote a new awareness of their awareness. Dr. Beckhoff?
One of the real exciting things in my field, ethology, cognitive ethology, the study of animal minds, study of animal emotions, is there's always surprises. So one big surprise was last fall, we discovered that mice are empathic, that when a mouse sees another mouse in pain, they experience the pain of that mouse, and they show a lower threshold to pain. We also discovered that whales have spindle cells, and spindle cells were thought only to exist in humans and other great apes. But now we know whales have them, and whales have more of them, and they are very important in experiencing emotions and intuition and gut reactions, emotional gut reactions. So people who have studied whales know and have told me over and over again that they're emotional beings. But some really interesting stuff comes out, and I'm really interested in how the press is picking things up. The New York Times is constantly having articles on animal cognition. Do animals have a sense of time? The notion of empathy in animals. And right before I started talking, you know, to Sydney, there was an article called I Am an Elephant that appeared in a newspaper in Philadelphia that really, really decried the keeping of elephants in captivity and how they need to go to sanctuaries and not be kept in little prison-like cages in zoos. And what's really neat about that is the popular press is getting into the story about the way elephants and, of course, other animals suffer trauma. And what's really interesting is that 6 zoos in America have decided that they would be closing their elephant exhibits as the elephants passed away or got ill and had to be sent to a sanctuary, including the Bronx Zoo, the Detroit Zoo, the Philadelphia Zoo. So that's new. And recently I saw an article that fishermen have fishermen who are getting now very frustrated that overfishing has caused the depletion of the fish who they try to catch for fun or for food. And out in Oregon, because of the decrease in salmon, fishermen are starting to shoot sea lions. And I'm saying that as, of course, that's a horrible thing. But, you know, once again, that's what's happening. So I think the exciting thing in my field is that we're continually learning about the fascinating worlds of animals, their emotional and their intellectual abilities.
We've devoted an entire show to Dr. Bekoff's work, which you can easily find by Googling B-E-K-O-F-F on the Google search block on the Wildside News homepage. Unfortunately, the advances so many of us are experiencing have seemed in the last number of years to be countered by the effects of power and politics, and perhaps nowhere is it more challenging than in some of our agency policies that have taken a beating of late. Dave Foreman, who lives and works in the Southwest, is dedicated to restoring vast stretches of open and interconnected habitat to create extensive land bridges of healthy ground to restore a natural order. He runs into obstacles regularly. Dave?
Most Americans, when they hear the name United States Fish and Wildlife Service, would logically think that it's an agency designed to protect animals, and in some cases they're right. However, for much of its history, the Fish and Wildlife Service's main mission has been to kill animals, and particularly predators and other troublesome species like prairie dogs. During the first half of the 20th century, the Fish and Wildlife Service conducted an extermination campaign to get rid of predators such as wolves, mountain lions, and grizzly bears from the lower 48 states. But in the 1980s and 1990s, with the turnaround in public attitude towards large carnivores, the Fish and Wildlife Service led the effort to recover wolves in the western United States, the wolves indeed that it once killed. And this led to the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone National Park in 1995. And in Arizona and New Mexico in 1997, the reintroduction in the wild of the lobo, the Mexican wolf, the most endangered carnivore in the world. Dave Parsons, now of the Rewilding Institute, led this effort as the team leader for the Fish and Wildlife Service. But now, under the political commissars of the Bush administration, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has turned to its old ways and is leading a second extinction campaign of lobos in the wild, doing this for a handful of public land ranchers. Right now, violating all the recommendations from conservation biologists and others and their former guidelines, the Fish and Wildlife Service, lack of management, lack of protection, willingness to kill the endangered lobos in the wild if they so much as look at a cow, is leading rapidly to their extermination in the wild. If India mismanaged its tigers in the reprehensible way the United States is managing its lobos, the world would be outraged. If Kenya was mismanaging its lions the way the Federal Wildlife Agency is mismanaging our lobos, there would be an international outcry. And if Spain had a war of elimination against its wolves and against the highly endangered Iberian lynx, there would be outrage all over the world. But the United States is now exterminating the lobo in the southwestern United States. And where is the outrage? Where is the international outcry? Indeed, where is the national outcry? It's an outrage going on now in Arizona and New Mexico for a handful of public lands ranchers, and it's being conducted by our federal government and by the political commissars that the Bush administration has put into the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. I want to encourage listeners to write your member of Congress and your United States senators to protest what has happened with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and to call on Congress to have oversight hearings on the Fish and Wildlife Service's war of extermination against the lobo in the southwestern United States.
Thanks, Dave Foreman of the Rewilding Institute. This basis for maintaining vast stretches of the natural landscape has some surprising, often difficult to recognize dynamics that, if altered, can have ripple effects over vast stretches and spaces. Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, who directs the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment, weighs in on this expanded perspective. Dr. Lovejoy?
People have been concerned for some time now about tropical rainforests. And they are great biological treasure troves. But one of the things that is quite remarkable, in particular about the Amazon, but it probably occurs too in other tropical forests as well, the Amazon literally makes half of its own rainfall. And it does this because the air moves from the Atlantic to the Andes. It brings moisture from the ocean. It drops as rain. And then it evaporates off the complex surfaces of the forest, and the trees are exhaling moisture, and that turns into clouds and rain farther to the west. So ultimately, if you cut down too much of the forest, you break that cycle and you can't even grow a rainforest. One of the really interesting things we know now is that something like 40% of the rain south of the Amazon, South America, actually comes from the Amazon. So in the end, people who don't care about that extraordinary variety of living things in the rainforest don't necessarily care about forests, certainly need to care about it as a rain machine. And it's just one more example of how interdependent we are with nature and are only just beginning to appreciate.
Thank you, Dr. Lovejoy. Good science is blending into a more holistic understanding of the many dimensions involved in the living world. And even as research continues, so too the debates, often between the scientists themselves, about how this is playing out and our future. Dr. Robin Moore, who faces the daunting challenge of awakening the world to the fact that the amphibians as a class of animals are facing the possibility of total collapse within 10 years, pushes the questions as the future reality is being felt. Dr. Moore.
In this month's edition of the journal Nature, an article by Ross Alford and co-workers in Australia fuels debate on the role that climate change is playing in global amphibian declines. The article is a response to a study by Alan Pounds and co-authors linking the decline of amphibians as a result of a fungal disease, chytridiomycosis, or chytrid for short, to climate change in Costa Rica. Pounds and colleagues propose the mechanism for disease outbreaks in which global warming favors a pathogen by shifting temperatures towards its optimum. Unusual climatic conditions may also stress amphibians, potentially altering development and raising susceptibility to chytrid fungus as well as other diseases. The analysis of Pounds et al. Has been questioned by many authors, who are skeptical of the real relationship they state, sparking debate on the role of climate change in amphibian declines. Alford and team present data from amphibian declines in Queensland, in which the period of regional declines coincides with dramatic regional warming, mirroring the global trend, while Alford and colleagues suggest that multi-year warm periods are more important in amphibian declines than single warm years. The patterns from the Australian tropics that they present agree with the climate-linked epidemic hypothesis presented by Pounds. While analyses linking climate change with amphibian declines may be contested, evidence is definitely mounting that climate change and amphibian declines are frequently linked. To me, this raises a question about the trade-offs between continued research and conservation action. What point do we consider the evidence to be conclusive enough to take appropriate action to mitigate the threat? Personally, I favor the precautionary approach. I don't question the importance of strong scientific evidence in providing credibility to an argument, and I do think scientific debate is healthy. I also think it is important to act in the midst of a crisis, even if all the pieces do not yet seem to be in place. While people continue to debate whether amphibians are really declining and whether climate change really plays a role, I think it's prudent to accept the very real possibility that both are in fact occurring, and do what we can to reverse these alarming trends.
Dr. Moore works with Conservation International, which, like the Rewilding Institute, is reconnecting the critical habitats around the world. Their work requires much greater support. One area that is receiving a lot of attention these days is energy and its sources. That debate will not be settled for many years, but that debate must be waged. Carl Pope, who leads the Sierra Club, weighs in on one of the proposed good solutions for our energy future. Carl?
Retro can be fun. The Bee Gees singing Saturday Night Fever won't kill you. But when we're told that our energy future is a choice between Coolidge-era coal burners and Khrushchev-era nukes, nostalgia's killing us. Liquid coal is the latest deadly retro fad. It's an apartheid-era South African technology to make coal a motor fuel. It's filthy and dangerous. What an oil addict shoots up when he's desperate. Most of its energy is turned into waste carbon pollution. A car that runs on coal is more than twice as dirty as one that runs on Arabian crude. It's wildly economic. You can't afford it. But Washington can fix that. Just pump the coal full enough of taxpayer dollars. Guarantee the government will buy it, however dirty and expensive, and voila, coal industry campaign contributors get grateful, and our climate gets fried. This is a fix for our oil addiction we don't need and can't afford.
The Sierra Club. Now that's one organization that's been standing up for land, people, and our heritage for a very long time. And you'll find a Sierra Club and members in every community. There's a lot being heaped onto the dreams of the new environmentalists. It's fascinating to see this historic effort being carried now by the newly enfranchised. Ben Lowe has taken up that challenge, and he talks about it now. Ben?
Our world is in a mess. Have you seen the signs? I've seen how we blow up entire mountains to get at coal underneath. I've seen street children with swollen bellies picking through mounds of garbage for food. I've seen forests burning and rivers dying. I've seen the reports and bleak predictions for our future, the future that I'm inheriting. I've seen these things, and they cannot be hidden from my conscience any longer. But do we still stand a chance? Is it even possible to fix? I hear this question a lot, and I can certainly relate to that feeling. It's easy to despair, and I often feel overwhelmed. But whenever I need inspiration, I look to my peers, and I see a passion and an idealism that energizes me. My generation has a big role to play today, and we have the power to bring real, lasting good. I'm reminded of Wilberforce and his campaign to outlaw slavery in England. They recently released a film on this story called Amazing Grace. In it, the young Prime Minister William Pitt tells his abolitionist friend, Wilberforce, "We're too young to realize that certain things are impossible, so we'll do them anyway." I think there's a lot of truth to that. They eventually succeeded in the huge task before them. And by the grace of God, so will we.
When you wonder what to do, a great choice may be to locate a youthful warrior and mentor them, support them, give them the encouragement they will need to carry on. And that's what our final regular guest is going to offer up, and that is his sage advice on what needs to be done with this enormous challenge from the perspective of a scientist and visionary who determined a few years back that it was time to get busy and really get things done. Dr. Charles Kennell.
I would say that the time for diagnosis is over. We know a lot of what the problems are. We can't wait for a perfect understanding of the sustainability diseases that we have to start working on them. And we have to make progress in many, many different areas. And and I would say that it's now time to stop diagnosing, start writing prescriptions, start developing cures.
As director of Scripps Institution of Oceanography, Dr. Kennell has experienced the most contiguous and complex ecosystem on Earth. Thank you, Dr. Kennell, and thank you for joining us for the Weekly Earth Summit. We close segment one on the Wild Side News here with a reading from the speech Rachel Carson delivered in acceptance of the National Book Award in 1963, and dedicate this to Senator Tom Coburn, our next Pombo. Ms. Carson said, Mankind has gone very far into an artificial world of his own creation. He has sought to insulate himself in his cities of steel and concrete from the realities of earth and water and growing seed. Intoxicated with a sense of his own power, he seems to be going farther and farther into more experiments for the destruction of himself and his world. There is certainly no single remedy for this condition, and I am offering no panacea. But it seems reasonable to believe, and I do believe, that the more clearly we can focus our attention on the wonders and the realities of the universe about us, the less taste we shall have for the destruction of our race. Wonder and humility are wholesome emotions, and they do not exist side by side with a lust for destruction. Rachel Carson, 1963. Stay tuned as we explore a timely example of exactly this dilemma when we head to California and Alaska for Two Tales of Whales, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.